Issues, etc. 24, Hour 12, starts now.
This came as a shock to me because I was raised in a Lutheran home, Lutheran education, and never once, this is something I never considered. Of course, I was raised in a conservative Lutheran home, in a conservative Lutheran church and school and education for the most part, not as conservative as it could have been, but, and I mean theologically conservative. But I remember listening to a guest who's going to be on with us here in about an hour, Craig Parton, and he was not raised in a Lutheran home, and he came out of evangelicalism. And when he was beginning to become disillusioned with the shallowness of evangelicalism, he was kind of looking around. He said many times on Issues, etc., he never, until kind of forced to, even considered joining a Lutheran church. And why? He said among the many things that he thought he knew about Lutherans, the one thing he thought he knew for sure about Lutherans was that they were the liberals. And coming out of evangelicalism, that's one of the things he didn't want. He didn't want the emptiness. He didn't want to trade the emptiness of American evangelicalism for the emptiness of mainline Protestant liberalism, and that's where he thought Lutherans firmly belonged. Now, why is that? And what do we mean when we say liberal? And is this myth about Lutherans, many are liberal, but is this myth about Lutherans that they're liberal, is it true? Back with us for this next hour of Issues, Etc., 24-hour live, 24-hour broadcast on this Friday evening, November the 4th, Dr. Martin Noland. He's former director of the Concordia Historical Institute and pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. Marty, welcome back.
Good to be here again.
How do you explain that? I mean, Craig Parton has mentioned this many times, that in his evangelical days, when considering where to go, he thought about Rome, he thought about going east, he thought about all those things. He never considered Lutherans because if there's one thing he thought he knew about them, they were just those old mainline Protestant liberals like all the others.
Well, I think that perception depends on where you are in American Christianity. I remember my wife and I visited, we stayed overnight when we went to the Amish country in Pennsylvania. This is what they call the Pennsylvania Dutch, and a friend of ours hooked us up with somebody. She was a Mennonite lady and very conservative, and so over dinner at her house, we discussed our mutual religions, and she was kind of surprised, and I was kind of surprised. She kind of thought that Lutherans were liberal, and the reason she thought that was because, and this goes way back in Pennsylvania, all the way back to the time of the Revolutionary War, is that the Lutherans didn't have any blue laws, that is, what type of color that you could dress. The Pennsylvania Dutch said it had to be black. They didn't have other types of clothing restrictions. Lutherans smoked, oh my gosh, tobacco, and they danced, and they played cards, and, you know, they seemed to have a good time. And so for the Mennonite lady, that was kind of liberal. Now, I've also met, and this would be my father's side of the family, were mostly Baptists, some First Christian Church, which comes out of the first, the evangelical revivals of the beginning of the 19th century. But anyway, they're Baptists mostly, maybe some Methodists. And they thought Lutherans were liberal because they drink beer and wine, and drink a lot of it sometimes. Well, that's true, too. And then there's the whole issue of abolitionism and the influence and the impact of Lutherans in the United States prior to the Civil War in the abolition movement. And maybe we'll get time to talk about that. But it was the first time that Lutherans in America really took a stance on a social issue. And most of the pastors and congregations and what were known as the General Synod at the time came out in favor of abolitionism, not just that they were against slavery, but let's free the slaves and not pay their masters back. You know, John Brown, go with him, you know, great guy. This is a rather very progressive or liberal social view. And by the way, that was being centered at the General Synod Seminary and College, which was at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. So evidently they got that right in their backyard a couple years later. Finally, there is, I think, what affected Mr. Roseboro, and that is that the mainline churches in the United States have a very cozy relationship with each other. And it goes back, it goes back to sometime in the 19th century. The institution that I went to and got my doctoral degree is one of those institutions where the idea was, let's get together the different large denominations that are wealthy and that are well-established, and let's try to cooperate and do things together and maybe learn from each other. That was Union Theological Seminary in the city of New York. You know, the title says Union Theological Seminary. Now, the Lutherans on the East Coast, excuse me, although they originally were not part of Union Seminary, by the time I was there, there were some there. Larry Rasmussen is now retired, was professor of social ethics, and he's had a great influence, in terms of a lot of influence in the ELCA social pronouncements. He was a professor at Union. David Lotz was in church history, my professor, my doctoral advisor. And although he wasn't a professor there, Richard Don Newhouse was often around campus talking to these people. And, you know, they socialize with each other. They know what's going on in their denominations. And furthermore, they are experts in public relations. The American Publicity Bureau, American Lutheran Publicity Bureau,
ALPB,
thank you, was an organization of Missouri Synod Lutherans that were watching the mainline Protestant denominations and said, you know, they have something we don't have, and that is they don't have an office of public relations. We're not getting the word out in a general sense at the denominational level of who we are or what we stand for. And nor are they doing that at the congregational level. And that was the original impetus for the ALPB. But the ALPB then eventually did some of this networking. The National Council of Churches is just south, right across the street from Union Theological Seminary. And the National Council of Churches building used to have most of the major denominations. Now it's been vacated. I think they're in Washington, D.C. But what happens then is when you've got this sort of networking, so that your journalistic people, they want to know what's going on, but they don't want to have to go to 20 different denominational headquarters. They want to be able to go to one place and to one person and say, okay, what does this mean? What's going on? And how can we explain it to the American public? And so Richard, I don't remember his name, he's now retired, probably deceased. He was a good friend of Richard John Newhouse, and the two often commiserated. And he was the official correspondent, Richard Oslin, is that the, no, I can't think of the name, used to write for Time magazine, very astute journalism on what was going on in American Protestantism and Catholicism at the time. And all he had to do was take a trip over to the National Council of Churches or Union Seminary and talk to those people, and they not only knew what was going on in their denomination, they knew what was happening in all the others. And so the Lutheran Church in America, 1962, when it was formed, and the ALC, when it was formed about 1960, they said, we got to be there. We got to get our connections, even if we don't have our headquarters there. We got to be in that connection so that our name and what we're doing and what we stand for gets out. And so when the LCA and ALC did this, the Missouri Synod said, wait, we need to be there too. So they formed this thing called the LCUSA, LCUSA, in New York, and the idea was to get out what we're all about. And so the way that Lutherans were portrayed in the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s, was as if they're together with the mainline denominations. Now, it's true that the LCA and ALC went in that direction. It's not true that the Missouri Synod was part of that. But I think that's how, in recent generations, people got the impression that Lutherans were liberal.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the fact that how it came. Well, let's do something more basic than that.
Okay.
First. Let's define what we mean by liberal here. What are the parameters of that term when it comes to kind of our working framework, mainline liberal Protestantism?
Well, first off, you have to realize that the term liberal is very subjective. It's used by people to define things that they don't like. And so a lot of people use the term liberal and conservative in very fluid and not helpful ways. But we can use the term liberal in a positive way as a political and social philosophy, referring to the ideas of what we might call republican democracy, constitutionalism, rule of law, civil rights, that was instituted by John Locke, and then, or it was developed by John Locke, instituted in his Carolina Constitution, and then took flesh in the United States Constitution and its legal system. There is another sense of liberal that has to do with theology, and that's a whole other development. And it really goes back, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, but I think I need to explain it right now. It goes back to the time right after the Napoleonic Wars, when the Germans were in a great flux. They realized that they didn't have to have kings anymore, and they could be like the Americans or the French during the Revolution, and the people could be free. And so there were philosophers, not just scholarly type of guys that are trying to figure out how a deduction works and logic and fallacies and stuff like that, but a real philosopher concerned with the politics of the day. And these guys were Lessing and Kant and Herder and Schelling and Fichte and Hegel. And they were all about a revolution at the social level for the common man. And these were the liberals in Germany. And they were writing, and they were also criticizing religion because they thought that religion was constricting them and preventing their freedom. And it probably was true for their case. And so this notion of liberalism being found in these philosophers, those people that wanted to be liberal in a political sense accepted what the philosophers said about knowledge and about religion, in particular Kant. And the first person to put those two things together was Friedrich Schleiermacher. He accepted what Kant said, and which basically debunked the Bible as an authority, and says it has to come out of the intuition of man. And even today, where you have church assemblies that decide what the Word of God is, that really goes back to Friedrich Schleiermacher and his notion of how God reveals himself through the community and through the parliamentary assembly. So that is the notion, the basic notion of liberal Protestantism. It's had many different leading thinkers and intellectuals and various movements, but the basic idea is that God speaks through the parliamentary assembly of the church, and that is the Word of God.
Okay, so we do not have Lutherans originally buying into the presuppositions of essentially the Enlightenment. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, it's particularly the German Enlightenment that affects this in the Lutheran area. Go ahead.
And they were not originally liberal in their social moral views. When does it begin to affect all the entire complex of Lutheranism, not just social moral views, but also theological views? I mean, what I'm looking at here, Marty, is if you take the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America as kind of the example for us to kind of examine here, you have a church body that is not just theologically liberal, that is buying into the Enlightenment ideas about truth,
right,
Scripture, all those things, but also almost avant-garde in its social moral liberalism now. How do those two things come together in liberal Lutheranism?
Yeah, it's a very complex story, and we probably can't do justice to it right now, but I'll try to give you the short version. Okay, we go back to how does Lutheranism become theologically and morally liberal? I think that's the question that you're asking. And because originally Lutherans at the time of the Reformation and up until Napoleon, they are very conservative in politics and in social mores and in morals and theologically too. So how does this all get? Well, it's the German Enlightenment that changes everything. And since the philosophers that I mentioned, I'll repeat those again, Gotthold Lessing, Johannes Herder, Immanuel Kant, Hegel, a few others, these were the German liberals from a philosophical and political standpoint. When their ideas were accepted by theologians, then that term liberal was applied to the theologian's doctrine. Now, we'll start with Friedrich Schleiermacher. He fused Reformed theology with Kant's philosophy. They believed at that point, the liberal Protestant says, I can no longer follow strictly the Bible as a source of doctrine. I need to be up to date. I need to follow what modern philosophy has accepted and shown to be true, at least what they believe is true. And so he takes Kant's philosophy, which is really tells you what you can and you can't think, what you can and can't know. That's called Kant's critical philosophy. And then he merges what he knows about theology from his Reform background and puts the two together. Schleiermacher is the father of all liberal Protestantism in this sense. And then you have F.C. Bauer, who applies Hegel's ideas of thesis and antithesis to the Bible. He says, well, there's Peter, he's thesis, and there's Paul, he's antithesis. And then you have a synthesis, which is James or whatever. And then you have Albrecht Ritschl, who adopts principles of neo-Kantianism. And Adolf von Harnack, at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, synthesized all these ideas for the common guy into what he calls the essence of Christianity, which is the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. Now, Adolf von Harnack was one of the scholars who said, go get 'em, speaking to the king and emperor of the Germans, when the king and emperor of the Germans wanted to destroy the British Empire. So Adolf von Harnack, who otherwise was a Christian, was actually one of the instituting people for World War I, where a lot of our boys died overseas, as did the French and the British, because of German militarism. And Adolf von Harnack was in charge of that, you might say, from a theological level. And he was the one that saying that the essence of Christianity is the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. So there is a great irony. And after the war, people realized the hypocrisy of liberal Protestantism of the day. And this then has a reaction in Karl Barth and the dialectical theologians, who rejected the easy accommodation of the church to modern culture, especially in the area of social ethics. So it's Karl Barth, who is a liberal, who brings in the idea of social ethics, that the church has to be responsible, the church has to be the guardian of the poor and the oppressed, and it has to be the social conscience for the nation. Otherwise, you will have another world war, which, of course, they did. In the United States, then, what we have is liberalism that grows out of three possible sources. One, you have Anglicanism, which was influenced by deism. You have Unitarianism in Boston, which is kind of a homebrew type of thing for America. Or it was imported from Germany through the liberal Protestant forms. And all those three influences merged together in the post-war period, in the 1950s, in the theology of the Niebuhr brothers and the theology that happens in the divinity schools in the United States. And they just bowl over whatever was left of Lutheran theology in the LCA and the ALC. It also affects the Missouri Synod, and they attempt to take over our Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. And then this led to, of course, a great struggle and conflict in our church in the 1960s and early 1970s, leading to the election of John Teachin as president at the St. Louis Seminary and Jacob Preuss as the president of the synod. You couldn't ask for a better thesis and antithesis there. And the result was the Missouri Synod, after great battles, finally repudiated the liberal Protestant doctrine. It was not just a matter of biblical criticism. It was repudiation of the entire liberal Protestant program and going back to our original founders' theology as found in Walther and Pieper and the Book of Concord.
What do you mean by that? It wasn't, because often it's called the battle for the Bible. It sounds like you're saying that really is an oversimplification of what took place within the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod when it found that at least in terms of its seminary faculty and a fair number of faculty elsewhere in educational institutions, it was liberal.
Yeah, they were following the liberal Protestant theologians. There's no doubt about that. Even Herman Saucy, when he visited the United States and visited our Concordia Seminary, he had the opportunity to become a guest professor there, and they rejected his application. And this, I believe, was post-war, would have been early 1950s. They realized, with his knowledge of liberal Protestantism, that he would have exposed them. They were trying to keep that under wraps. This began early in the 1950s with Jaroslav Pelikan. In his book, you can see it from Luther to Kierkegaard, tries to argue that the development of German Lutheran theology or German theology was a positive thing and that the Missouri Synod should accept that. And that Kierkegaard was the logical outcome because he was the father of existentialism, and that was really popular in the 1950s and 1960s, and was the way that we could speak to the culture of the day. And this is the type of stuff that was going on. It was not just in the exegetical department in the area of biblical higher criticism. It was also happening in the church history departments, in the systematic theology department, and as well as in pastoral theology, too. But primarily, it was a change of theology in principle so that the scriptures was no longer the authority, but rather the theology of the day, whatever was popular.
Now, I don't want anyone to get the impression that we're kind of painting all Lutherans as liberal. We're obviously laid the groundwork there to talk about a distinction between, a rough distinction between liberal and conservative, I would say liberal and confessional Lutherans. So where would you locate liberal Lutheranism today?
Well, in the United States, the mainline denomination is the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, or known as the ELCA, and they are connected to the Lutheran World Federation, which is about 68 church bodies, and those include the state churches in Europe and their mission provinces. And that's where you will locate the liberal Lutheranism today. You will also find it in some of the state church or the state universities where they have theology departments that are not necessarily part of the church. And the conservative side, you'll find, or the confessional side, you'll find the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod, and the Evangelical Lutheran Synod in the United States. And they have sister churches which follow our theology all around the world through the International Lutheran Council, which is the Missouri Synod side, and the Confessional Evangelical Lutheran Conference, which is the Wisconsin Synod and ELS-related churches around the world. So we really are a divided faith, or you'd say a large denomination or tradition. The Lutherans are really split in two. It's a basic theology. I mean, you could walk into the church and see that the ELCA church and a Missouri Synod church might conduct the same liturgy. The pastors have the same gowns, choir sing Bach, and everything else. But if you listen to the sermon, and especially to the Bible class, you'll be hearing something different. And then when it comes to social issues, which you brought out before, the most recent issue that is divided is the gay agenda, where ELCA has adopted accepted the blessing of gay marriages and the ordination of gays and lesbians, and the Missouri Synod does not. Missouri Synod does not, obviously, because the New Testament says that this is a serious sin, and it needs to be repented of and not to be blessed. The ELCA, because it derives its theology from the Parliamentary Assembly, when the ELCA in its assembly said it's okay, then that's the Word of God and they can do it, and that's what they believe.
So how do you explain that, that at least they haven't been the most forward of the mainline Protestant denominations, the ELCA, but they certainly haven't been trailing behind. A lot of us expected them to move more cautiously into their affirmation of homosexuality, homosexual clergy, things like that. But they seem to almost feel like they're in a bit of a foot race with the United Church of Christ or with, maybe the Episcopal Church USA. They have passed, even the Reformed bodies, liberal Reformed bodies, in their pursuit of that particular agenda. How do you explain that?
Yeah, that's an interesting... Nobody has written that story yet, so I have to do this from my own personal experience. When I went to Union Theological Seminary, I went there with the intent of studying church history, and I found out that it was the center of the gay agenda movement in the liberal Protestant churches. It was kind of a shock to me, and certainly when my wife visited... we were still dating at the time. She visited a couple years later. She was shocked to find that, too. She wondered about me, of course. What are you doing there? And I learned from that that the United Church of Christ was really the first to go this direction. And it trailed. The first thing that happened in the United Church of Christ was the ordination of women. And after the ordination of women... came the push for the ordination of lesbians and gays. The same thing was happening in the Episcopal Church, maybe a little bit out of sequence there, but the same thing. And I found when in my second, third, and fourth year there in residence, when new students came on campus, the older students and graduate students would sit down with them at lunch and dinner, talk to them about their theology, and particularly with the women would say, well, are you planning to be ordained? Yes, of course. You know, the New Testament says that's wrong. Well, yeah, but we don't accept that. Why don't we accept that? And they go through the arguments and then say, well, if that's true, then what's wrong with homosexuality? They would always use the same arguments, and they converted a lot of people over to the homosexual agenda through that method. And this was going on, as I found out, also at Harvard Divinity School, a lesser degree at Princeton, which was considered more conservative, at University of Chicago, at Claremont, at many of these large mainline denomination schools. And they were feeding then future leading pastors, future professors, out into the denominations. And now, with that effect, it's being pushed and organized to do that. And why did it take the Lutherans so long? Well, I found out that the people at Union thought Lutherans were somewhat conservative. And then they found out that I was Missouri Synod, and they said, oh, you're from the Stone Age. So, or a dinosaur or something like that. But they did see, they understood that in many senses the Lutherans have been very reluctant to make social changes. And so then the question is, why did the Lutherans, as you said, get into this gay agenda faster than, let's say, the Reformed Church in America or the United Methodists? And I think that has a lot to do with the AELC, and that's the group of people that came out of the Missouri Synod. They were rabid. I mean, they were frothing at the mouth type of rabid radicals. And when they came into association with the ALC and LCA at their seminaries, they disturbed all sorts of apple carts. Carl Broughton probably has nothing good to say about them. Carl Broughton was, I believe, a professor at LSTC with the LCA, and today he's written his memoirs in a very very intriguing to see that. And I think he realized that those radicals were out to change the church entirely and brought with them, from the Missouri Synod, the gay agenda, which was underground. We didn't even know about it. And so then when the ELCA was formed, the ALC was seen, the parts that came from there were kind of seen as the leading lights, and they wanted to be in the forefront, in the new wave, as it were, of all the mainline Protestants. And so I think the AELC actually propelled the ELCA. That, what I'm trying to say is the AELC unit within the ELCA pushed them toward the gay agenda. And if you read some of the recent reports that have now been published about the history of those assemblies and the things leading up to it, I think that affirms that. That may explain why this has happened.
So we're looking at this happening. Most of us, I'm sure you probably have a little better perspective on it, say, what happens next? Where do you go next when you are attempting to be on the leading edge of following the culture's cue on the social moral issues and trying to be avant-garde in new theological thinking? Where does liberal Lutheranism go next? What do they do? How do they top themselves?
Yeah, that's a good question now, because I think they've kind of exhausted their bag of tricks. I think their methods are now well known, and maybe they've just exhausted themselves. I mean, this group that accomplished this in the mainline denominations, they're baby boomers, and they're aging, and they're running out of steam. You know, they really got into this really as a civil rights issue. They were teenagers when the minority civil rights issue, that is the blacks, started protesting, and the whites joined them. And we can see a lot of positive things that came out of that. We haven't solved the civil rights issues yet in the United States, but that's how they got involved back in the late 50s and early 60s. And you know, the hippie movement was something entirely different. That was more like, let's get out of the, let's just walk away from society. The guy to read on this, I don't know if it's still in print, is Oz Guinness's Dust of Death.
Great book.
Excellent book. I mean, when I read this in college, I said, now this explains everything that's going on. And it was the political pushers and radicals, and he names all the different groups that were really, so it's a generational thing for that group of baby boomers. It's the progressives within the Democratic Party, which, by the way, just suffered a great setback, if you didn't notice. So they're running out of steam, and maybe they've gone as far as they can go. I don't know. The historian can only tell you what has happened up until the most recent generation. I can't tell you when it's going to go after this.
Finally then, Marty, the myth is that Lutherans are liberal. What is the beating heart and soul? It is not that long ago that the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod made a very brave statement about its more liberal counterpart in the United States, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, that because of the changes in theology and practice it had enacted, it had forfeited, in the minds of the Missouri Synod, it had forfeited the name Lutheran. That was a very bold statement. It wasn't received by everyone in a friendly way, but it was necessary to make that statement as a confession of the faith. What is the heart and center of the Lutheran Church that makes it necessary for us to say there is a point at which we have to say you can no longer claim to be Lutheran if you're going to be that liberal?
I'd say there are two ideas that we preserve within our denomination. And the first is that conservative Lutherans accept the entire Scriptures as the inspired, inerrant Word of God, and thus the only source and norm of theology. This is, once Luther discovered that and shaped it and understood it and was able to pass it on, that guided the rest of his reform, and it guided the Lutheran Church up until the Enlightenment period. The second point is that this idea of dogma, that Christian doctrine is a perennial authority in the church. It doesn't change from generation to generation. Generations change, cultures change, society changes, but the doctrine does not. And the whole notion of a doctrine is that it is perennial. It is not affected by history or the changes of history. It does not progress. It is because it's unique. It has been given by God as a word to inform and to guide and comfort Christ's church from the time that Jesus left this earth until the time that he returns. And those are two things that are unique to the conservative Lutherans, and I think that are absolutely true to Luther's own notion of reform.
Dr. Martin Noland is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. He is former director of the Concordia Historical Institute, and he's pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. Marty, it is always a pleasure. You've been very helpful, and thank you for your participation in Issues Etc. 24.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
When we come back, we're going to turn to the myth of myths. Well, any of these could probably qualify here, but I think the myth of myths about Lutheranism is the one we're going to take up next with Craig Parton. It's not a new one. It's not an old one. It's actually a rather new myth. Oh, less than 50 years old. Lutherans can have Lutheran substance while also having evangelical style. There's even a book written about this about 20 years ago that, well, I don't know if the book was that influential or if it just kind of tapped into the zeitgeist of a lot of Lutherans who wanted to believe that myth. This is one of the myths, most of the myths of Lutheranism Lutherans don't want to believe. This is one that a lot of them really, really do want to believe. The myth about Lutheranism having evangelical style and Lutheran substance. Craig Parton will be our guest on the other side for an hour-long conversation as part of Issues Etc. 24 on this Friday evening, November the 14th. I'm Todd Wilkin. More Issues Etc. 24 right after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
We should fear, love, and trust in God above all things, so that we believe and trust that in Christ Jesus we have everything that we need, and that we have received his word and sacraments, and that is all we need in this life as well as eternally, and that is made known to us daily through Issues Etc. Thanks be to God.
Thanks be to God, yes. And a congratulations to Adrian in around, what did you say, somewhere around Kansas City, Jeff? She was the winner of this hour's premium. It's a seminary in crisis. And thanks to you. And also have Dean to thank for renewing his membership in the Reformation Club.
You know, one of the highlights of the Issues Etc. 24 extravaganza is you get an opportunity, Craig and I get to take the credit card donations to actually talk to our listeners a little bit. Great conversation with Michelle in Encino, California. Thanks for your generous donation, Michelle. And you will be in the drawing an hour from now for Craig Parton's book, The Defense Never Rests, A Lawyer's Quest for the Gospel. Michelle, thanks so much for listening and for your support. And thanks to David in Spring, Texas for your donation as well.
The phone lines have gone quiet, Jeff. We need to hear the phone lines. If you'd like to support Issues Etc. during Issues Etc. 24, please give us a call. Our toll-free number, 877-623-6943, 877-623-6943. You can also go to issuesetc.org. There you can make a secure online donation with your credit card, PayPal account. Or if you're listening on demand, if you're not listening with us live, you can give us a call anytime here at the office, 618-223-8385, and any size donation will receive the book, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center.
I don't know where you're listening to Issues Etc. 24, but right now it's 10:06 in the evening Central Time here in Collinsville, Illinois, where our temperature is 25, and apparently we're expecting some snowfall tomorrow.
Yeah.
And we've got our first visitors. The Johnsons, Kurt and Julie Johnson from Hamel, Illinois, are in studio. They kindly brought us some I guess, supper. I guess we should call it supper. So thanks so much for doing
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Thank you.
It's our first visitors. When,
I don't know. Usually by now there's somebody asleep on the couch. Zach's been here for half the day. It's 10 o'clock, 12 hours through Issues Etc. 24, and that's our first guest.
It's not the first visitors. Craig has forgotten his own daughter.
Oh,
no,
that's
no,
funny.
No, no.
Yeah, she's not visitors. She's
didn't
family.
See, that's, yeah. I
These
knew where
are the
Jeff
first
was...
visitors you brought something to eat.
That's true.
I knew where Jeff was going with that. No, he's right. Family. That's family.
That's right. But your wife did offer to bring food.
She did. She did.
But you said that the Johnsons were going to bring bread.
I said, yeah, Julie is going to bring something barrel. Much better than yeah, Cracker Barrel. So
I just want to know that I'm going to have time to eat my Panera salad. Before we have to head off again.
We can give you about 3 or 4 minutes of music. A music interlude, about 3 or 4 minutes max. Can you do that, Wilkin?
You got to have two forks. You got to have two forks going.
I can get started, I suppose.
You know, I made a mention to about inane banter, and this just came in from Joshua in Iowa. He says, it will only get worse as the night goes on. And he's correct. Sounds like he's listened to a few Issues Etc. 24s over the years. So thanks so much for your support. Again, those numbers, 877-623-MY-IE, 618-223-8385 for the on-demand listeners. And online, a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. Support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. during Issues Etc. 24.